May it please the court, my name is William Taylor. I'll be presenting the argument for appellant interveners. With me at council table is Thomas Vartanian of the Deckard firm and Sean Naughton of my firm. I don't intend to spend very much time demonstrating the error of the decision in the district court. None of our adversaries seem to spend much time defending it either. Their notion is that this court should affirm for reasons not contained in the and not addressed by the district court. This court can, of course, do that, but the better course and the proper course in this case is to reverse. I'd like at the outset to make 2 points.
Counsel, before you go to your merits, I'd like to question you concerning standing. Now, in your brief, you suggested, you picked up on a suggestion, no holding in this court, a suggestion of the possibility that someone who intervenes as a defendant doesn't have to establish standing.
We do.
Now, I wanted to give you this hypothetical. Suppose someone is sued in Georgetown by a government agency claiming that their facade of their building is inappropriate under some environmental statute. And someone else in Georgetown with a house is thinking about, maybe I would like to put that facade on too. So I have an interest. Is it your view that I could, that person could intervene as a defendant? Because I don't think the defendant in the case is doing a good job arguing, and maybe he's too close or she's too close to a councilman. So I want to get in there, and because I want to protect myself in case the government comes after me.
And our hypothetical intervener doesn't have any other interest in the outcome of the case, I take it.
That's correct.
That seems to me that in the...
It's clear that the defendant, you wouldn't have standing, right?
I think not.
So that's enough for the proposition that you have to show standing as a defendant or a plaintiff. So therefore, that first argument you make, you're in effect conceding that away.
I think we're not conceding that we don't have Article III standing.
No, no, that's a separate point. In the brief, you argue the defendants didn't have to.
Oh, the defendants don't need standing.
Right, and you've abandoned that.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, one hesitates to abandon anything that might be of later value. But
I understand.
Our principal point is that we have standing, and then
some. Recognize that we have precedent, whether it's right or wrong, to the effect that defendant intervener also must have standing.
The prudent course, I believe, is...
Now, let me go on to the other question. Why do you have standing at all? Our cases seem to suggest that the interest in for intervention is the same as injury in fact for Article III.
We have injury in fact.
No, is that correct? That the interest prong of the 24, Rule 24, is the same as injury in fact under Article III?
That's what the precedent and the decisions in this court seem to us to say.
All right, now I want to push you on whether why you have Article III injury in fact. Why do you have injury? Injury in fact includes an interest, of course, but also includes an imminent threat to that interest. And that goes to the contingencies. Each contingency has to be more likely than not. Now, how can you show
that was
your interest is threatened with contingencies that are more likely than not?
I'm not sure that I have to show the contingencies are more likely than not. I think the operative word is may. But
is that correct? Under
yes.
Article
may
3
be,
standing?
May be impaired. That's
Article
3
standing, I think you have to show, we're talking about the confluence, the interconnection between injury and fact and causation. But it can't be speculative. The injury can't be speculative, right?
No, but it does not have to have, in fact, occurred.
No, you're absolutely right. But it has to be more likely than not, doesn't it?
I'm not so sure I would go that far.
That was true in Lujan.
Well, in Jones, which is the decision, a recent decision here, where, and also in Fund for Animals, and others, Mountaintop Condominium, where the interest of the intervener is in the ultimate resolution of the case before it. Its financial interest is determined by the litigation. And here, our clients are owners of notes which are trading on a daily basis based upon the monies in these funds they have presented.
Would I take it that you will abandon the argument that your other interveners have standing who are not the holders of notes, that is to say financial advisors?
We're not pressing that issue here.
I did not think so.
But
to make certain
to answer Judge Silberman's point, which I wanted to address first thing, the first point here is our clients own the notes. They presented the notes to the FDIC. The FDIC approved the notes as debts of this company.
You got the certificates,
and we are entitled to be paid from the funds, the $2.7 billion which the FDIC is holding. If this court decides the case in a way that is disadvantaged to us, the value of our notes, our ownership interest plummets. There cannot be any more dramatic harm.
Would any creditor of the failed bank have standing to intervene in this action?
No.
Why not? If you have standing because there's going to be less in the fund to meet the obligations owed to you, why would not every creditor?
Well, I'm afraid the answer, Judge, is it depends.
That's a great answer.
I know,
but
I'm sure you've heard that before. But
no, most people don't have the nerve to say that, Counsel.
Well, you and I have been at this before.
We've been at this a long time, yeah.
But
in various places. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. The answer is it depends. There are certainly the number of cases interpreting the definition of interest fills up more than half of a volume of writing.
You seem to be getting a long way from my question.
Because
the fund has an obligation to you, why does not every creditor of the failed bank have precisely the same claim for standing you did?
Because not every... First of all, if we are intervening, then other creditors meet the objection that they are adequately represented.
Oh, well, no, the next creditor is going to say...
First come, first served would be it then?
Indeed. One of the questions about adequate representation, mm-hmm. when there are multiple interveners, and this comes out of a Third Circuit case called Chrysler, if there are multiple seriatim interveners, the latter interveners will face...
Suppose the counsel, you cannot suppose you're going to beat them to the door every time. Why would they not have the same claim of standing you did?
Because...
Assume you're not here. Why would they not ever want
it? I'm not saying that they wouldn't, Judge.
Or they file simultaneously.
I'm not saying that they wouldn't. The nature of the intervention rule, it contemplates that there will be parties to the litigation who are not the original parties. But whether or not a particular individual creditor has the same kind of harm...
We have to worry about precedent.
Indeed, you do, but...
We would like to have, or I at least, and I think my colleagues would like to have an answer to that question. Why would not every single creditor of the failed bank have the same argument for standing that you assert for these creditors?
First of all, it may very well be that the distinction is the interest in this fund, which our clients have that nobody else in this picture has.
But the same theory,
and that is the theory here,
as I understand it, is you have standing because this current litigation could exhaust funds that would be available to pay to other creditors. I mean, that's not the way you phrase it exactly, but that's your theory of standing.
It is in the sense that our harm, the harm...
The only harm you can possibly suffer is if
correct.
This other litigation
causes
the funds not to be available to pay you, right?
It's not going to affect our personality. It's a matter of direct economic harm.
Which would be the same harm that would be available, the same claim of harm or theory of harm that would be available to any creditor.
Theoretically, that's true. And every court which deals with applications to intervene does have to ask the question whether or not you, intervener, creditor, or insurer who wants a declaratory judgment that he does not have to defend a particular party because or the plaintiff intervening in a declaratory judgment case because if the declaratory judgment of coverage goes against him, there's no money in the defendant, and that's Teague versus
Counsel,
Baker.
It's not just receivership. I think the position you're advocating would have awesome implication for bankruptcy trustees as well.
Well, I think bankruptcy is governed by a different.
Well, there's no, but still be the Article III problem.
If
you'd have Article III, when a bankruptcy case gets to the federal district court, you'd have the same kind of problem. You're taking the position, I can't, as Judge Sintel points out, we cannot, the next creditor comes along and says, you know what, the problem is that the last creditor, you, is incompetent. They're not presenting this case properly.
That will not get you anywhere.
Or he has a bad interest in this case. He's got some friend on the other side or something like that.
I cannot tell you where to draw the line in every potential case.
We know one way.
Well, let me ask you about that, okay? Because let me try to get at the question a different way in terms of where you draw the line. I read our cases, SEC versus Prudential Securities, Cleveland versus NRDC, these cases, as saying that for purposes of intervention, Article III standing requires a legally enforceable interest, not just an economic interest.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the way I read the cases. Do you agree with that?
That's the way the cases, that is exactly what the case is.
Okay. So if you look at it that way, since you asked for a line to be drawn, your clients don't have any legally enforceable interest in the issue in this case.
But we have a legally protectable interest.
But you don't have a legally, in other words, you have no stake, you have no legal stake. The consent, the agreement that's being litigated here provides no legal rights directly or indirectly to your clients.
We have never.
Correct?
We have never said we are parties or third party.
Right, but then isn't that the line? That you,
no.
Well,
no,
but you agreed with me. But you agreed with me that our cases draw the line at a legally enforceable interest, and that's what it seems to me that these two cases, particularly SEC versus
Prudential.
Yeah, the one the SEC relies on is awfully close to this case, and it said that they're the interveners. Although they were adversely affected economically in the same way you will be or could be by the interpretation of the agreement, of the consent decree there, agreement here, that's exactly the situation you're in with no legally enforceable interest.
To the contrary.
No, tell me why.
Because that position would put you directly in conflict with the Third Circuit.
But we have our own jurisprudence on intervention here,
course,
and our case law is very clear.
Of course, but there is.
I mean, if there's a conflict, the conflict exists because of SEC versus Prudential.
Well, indeed.
Not because of anything
this,
we do here.
This court has cited Mountaintop with approval.
Yeah.
But I'm not. That's not a mere technical response. Uh-huh. The answer is that in that case, as in many others, a particular owner intervened in a dispute between A and B because he contended that A owed him money, or in this case, in proceeds of an insurance payment. Uh-huh. A had contracted with B, the contractor, and they were using all of the monies that had been available to repair the condominiums which had been destroyed by the hurricane. The Third Circuit said, and I say this with advisedly, the question isn't whether he's a party to the contract. It's a question of whether he will be harmed. Does he have a legally protectable interest? And with all due respect, legally protectable interest doesn't mean legal interest in this contract. It means a legally protectable interest of some kind. It's not a mere economic interest.
Well, what about the argument, I can't remember, was it FDIC or one of the banks, but their argument is your client's legally protectable interest is a pro rata share of whatever the receivership is, even if it's zero.
But the FDIC...
That's your legally protectable interest, right? In other words, if the question were, are you or are you not entitled to a pro rata share, you would have a definite legal interest in that. But not...
I guess where you stand on this depends on where you sit, but from the point of view of a note holder,
right,
our legally protectable interest is to be paid the notes. And the notes, nobody contends, are invalid or have any defenses. They are legal obligations, and they're more, if I may say, than that of a general creditor or even a lessor.
Let me pursue the contingencies. You know, I'm still thinking of this as the classic Article III situation. And what are the contingencies that have to take place before you're injured?
The court...
You have an economic interest, okay.
The court...
When asking legally protected interest is another way of phrasing whether there is an imminent harm.
Right.
So what are the contingencies that have to take place before you face any injury?
There would have to be a final judgment that the claims of Deutsche Bank are payable from the FDIC.
That requires two separate legal conclusions, doesn't it?
At least two.
At least two. And what are the two major ones?
The first is whether or not J.P. Morgan or the FDIC has the liability, and the second is whether Deutsche Bank's claims are worth anything.
Right, right. Now, how do we know?
Isn't there a third issue, excuse me, which is whether they in fact have priority, right? That's
the
third
issue. Well, they'll be pro rata. Deutsche Bank does make the claim that these would be administrative expenses.
That's why I asked the question.
There is a separate.
That's your third issue.
Indeed, that's the third.
So there are three separate contingencies here.
Right. At least three.
And you know, if we look at classic Article III cases, if we look at the Supreme Court analysis on those, I don't understand why those contingencies are more likely than not. I can't think of any Supreme Court case that would hold this would be standing in their classic analysis.
Well, with all due respect, Judge Silberman, may I take on the premise? This case, this court decided Jones versus Prince George's County and held that a minor who had no legal right to bring a lawsuit.
That's an old case of ours.
That's not that old, and in fact...
It precedes a number of Supreme Court cases.
Actually, it's a relatively recent case.
Which case you're talking about?
Jones versus Prince George's County, written by Judge Tatel within the last...
Well, that's the problem.
Oh, what case?
Well, I'm not looking for cases that somebody else has decided.
I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to that case back in the 1960s.
No, I'm sorry.
I didn't realize you had a Judge Tatel
decision. I have a Judge Tatel decision, and I'm very fond of it.
But if that and 10 cents will get you on a trolley car.
Jones says you have to have Article III standing.
Right.
It does.
But that's the whole point.
Indeed. Right. And if we have to be a party or a third party beneficiary to this contract, then you should affirm.
Nobody's saying that. That's not the question you've been asked at all.
But the point I was trying to make in response to Judge Silberman, there is no harm to the minor until the decision is made in either the district court here or the court of Virginia. She's intervening to participate in the processing of the claim. Yes, she has an injury, but we don't know until the cases proceed to result whether that injury will be harmed or not by her presence or absence in the litigation. I think that is more the paradigm.
She had a procedural right, is that correct?
She had an Article III standing.
Yes, I know, but she was claiming a procedural right.
No, she was claiming Article III standing. She had no procedural right. She had no procedural right. It was conceded. She could not herself bring a case in her name, but she was permitted to intervene to advocate her interest. Same is true in SEC versus Navin, an older case. In an SEC settlement, And the same is true in Turbovich, if I may. In the Supreme Court's decision, a union member permitted to intervene when he could not assert a direct personal claim, but the Secretary of Labor, only the Secretary of Labor could sue to disallow an election. But the union member is permitted to intervene because he has a direct interest in that. And the Supreme Court didn't seem to be terribly concerned about the floodgates problem in that case. Indeed, there are a number of courts which have held, you know, the floodgates is always the parade of horribles. How do you...
Sometimes it is there.
No question about it, and one has to be alert to the consequences of every decision. I, with all due respect, certainly understand that. I think as an advocate for our position, we respectfully submit that our interest is Article III harm. And as I think Judge Garland said in Norton, it's harm and remediability. Our harm is palpable. And that's what gives you Article III standing. It's not whether you can be a party. It's whether you have harm.
Well, you have imminent harm.
Beg your pardon?
Imminent harm.
It's pretty imminent.
Okay.
The other. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jerome Madden. I'm counsel for the FDIC as receiver for WAMU. On the protectable interest that's required under Rule 24, the Court is asking questions that are dead on. You have to have a connection
Yes,
sir. You have to have a connection to the issues being litigated.
Yeah, but I suppose the proper question is, are the answers also dead on?
Well, I'll leave that to the Court, Your Honor.
Well, I thought that's what you'd want to talk about. I know we've got the right question.
Yeah. Well, the right answer, from our view, is you have to have a connection to the issues being litigated.
Well, they have a connection.
They have a connection, but not to the issues being litigated. They have an indirect economic interest, but not an interest in the issues being
litigated. Do you really want to make the question the connection? I mean, clearly they have a connection. They'll be adversely affected by how it's resolved.
I thought your point was
that they didn't have a legally enforceable interest in.
They do not have a legally enforceable interest.
So that's your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is they have no connection to the issues. And in contract cases, as in the SEC versus Prudential, you have to be a party or a third-party beneficiary to have that interest. We have two cases, one from the Ninth Circuit recently on this exact same P&A, GECCMC, and more recently, Interface Canner in the 11th Circuit, saying to have standing to argue about what the P&A means, you have to be a party or a third-party beneficiary. That gives you a connection to the issues that are being litigated. counsel mentioned several cases. In every case that they cite, there is the requisite legal interest in the issues that are being litigated. For example, counsel mentioned the Mountaintop case out of the Third Circuit. That's a case where the court took control of the insurance proceeds that went into the court registry. And the court said that's an exception to the general rule, you have to have a direct economic interest. But then it said, but the interveners cannot participate in the merits that are being litigated. They can only participate in when the court gets distributing the funds. And of course, that's not happening. The district court has no interest in the receivership funds. All it's going to do if it comes to having a judgment against the FDIC is issue a receivership certificate. So that case is clearly distinguishable. The Jones case in the Judge Tatel opinion in 2003 is a case where an infant's daughter's father was killed by the police and was a wrongful death action. And the court held you don't have to have a cause of action to intervene, but you have to have a direct legal interest being protected. The issues being litigated in that case were directly affecting her. The issues being litigated in the contract dispute between FDIC and JPMC.
So in terms of Article III standing, they were more imminent in that case? Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor. Direct, imminent.
You did make the argument in your brief that the intervener, prospective intervener, did not have Article III standing. What's a little puzzling about this case is that Rule 24 and Article III are expressed in different ways. although we have held that essentially the interest question in 24 is the same as injury in fact. And yet the interest is really, it talks about the economic interest, but that doesn't, when you talk about injury in fact, you also have to talk about an imminent threat to the interest.
Correct, Your Honor.
Which may be another way when we talk about the term legally protected. We're really talking about the likelihood of the interest being threatened.
It threatened directly by the issues being
right. But typically, injury in fact doesn't depend on your legal claim. It depends on whether you have injury in fact.
Right. Now, as I read the cases, Your Honor, the court is saying you have to have Article III standing to intervene. It may not be exactly the same as Article III standing to be a plaintiff, but you have to have some direct interest in the issues being litigated that can affect
your positive. Wait a minute. Why is Article III standing for intervention any different than Article III standing for as a plaintiff?
Well, as Judge Taylor
said, it's the same standard, isn't it?
My only point, Your Honor, in Jones, the court said that you don't have to have a cause of action to be an intervener.
No, cause of action is a separate matter. Right. That is in Article III. Right. That's a separate issue.
Right.
That's why this gets confusing.
The point is that you don't, when you think about Article III standing, we don't think in terms of whether the harm is a result of a legally enforceable. That's Judge Silverman's point.
Yeah.
And these are a little odd, these decisions that say legally enforceable, because we say you have to have Article III standing, but then we talk about it in a way that we aren't accustomed to thinking about it.
Right. Your Honor, that's why I say, Your Honor, in all the cases that...
The way to square it, I think, is that legally enforceable must refer to the imminence of the threat.
The imminence of the threat with respect to the issues being litigated.
Right.
For example, in the Navistar case...
With respect not to just the issues being litigated, the threat to your interest.
Direct threat.
Yes.
Somewhat akin to the remedial clause or step of the standing analysis.
That's another way of putting it.
Yeah. It has to be a direct threat, as Judge Silverman was pointing out. There are four contingencies here. The first is that the FDIC kept the liabilities under the PNA agreement instead of transferring to the JPMC. That's the first issue. The second issue, if the FDIC did retain those liabilities, is whether there's a judgment for Deutsche Bank on those liabilities. Mm-hmm. There are at least four or three other federal fraud securities cases on these exact same securitizations that are pending, and we don't know the outcome of them. Certainly, if they were to get judgments, they would also share in the pool of assets. And then there's the issue of the administrative expenses, where it's paid as administrative expense, as the court pointed out. So there's
one thing you did say in your brief that was sort of puzzling, with respect to the alleged conflict of interest. Your one response is you have a legal obligation to do your best to get the maximum assets for the creditors, which I understood. And then you make a point that, by the way, if we don't do that, we can't be sued anyway under sovereign immunity, which struck me as supporting the petitioner's, the appellant's position rather than yours. That was really mystifying.
I think the only reason, I think we have it in a footnote, Your Honor, but the reason is... I didn't mean to say that, but the point we were trying to make is that even if the interveners were entitled to intervene, they couldn't take any action to restrain us if we decided to settle with JPMC. That's because that discretion has been given to us by Congress. We have the obligation to maximize assets and minimize losses.
But that's their whole point. About the fact that the FDIC doesn't adequately represent their interests. That's what they're saying.
Yeah. Well, they're wrong.
Not only that you could settle, but that they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, that's truly bizarre. I mean, I can understand you're saying we have a legal obligation to do everything we can for the creditors, but then saying, and by the way, if we don't, you can't sue us anyway.
That was a bizarre
argument.
Yeah. Point taken.
You take it back?
No, I mean,
we can sue you.
Not in the sense that I intended it. In the sense that you took it, I see that was not what we were trying to convey. What we were trying to convey is that Congress made the policy decision to let the FDIC represent the interests of all creditors, to maximize assets and minimize losses. It also allows the FDIC to...
Appellant makes the argument you're really not a suitable character in this fight because you don't have an economic interest.
Well, that was my next point. Congress has made the policy decision that the FDIC... represents the creditors, and the FDIC can act in two legal capacities, which it did here in the PNA agreement. And so we have a presumption of regularity. We have a There's no allegation we have not faithfully carried out
robberies. We can't assume you would be corrupt.
You cannot assume we'd be corrupt, Your Honor.
All right, I understand.
So those are decisions that Congress has made. The other point I'd like to make is that as a matter of law, we adequately represent the interests of the creditors for reasons we were talking about, that FERIA is a comprehensive statute. We try to maintain the public confidence in the financial system when banks fail. We try to maximize assets on behalf of all creditors. Creditors can file a claim, and if it's denied, they can sue in court. There's no creditors committee analog in FERIA, as there is in the bankruptcy code. Congress certainly would know how to do that. And allowing them to intervene in this case, would every other creditor of the receivership has exactly the same interest here. And this would turn all of our cases into mini bankruptcy courts. We have 500 open receiverships in thousands of cases. And so I think as a matter of law, we represent the interests of all creditors. Secondly, Your Honor, on that point, I would like to say that the bondholders have a remedy. It's not that they don't have a remedy. At the end of the day, if they believe that we have somehow breached a duty to them in resolving the estate, they are entitled to bring a Federal Tort Claims Act action if they wish, subject to all the limitations of sovereign immunity that are in it. So it's not that they don't have a remedy. It's just that Congress did not intend for creditors to come in effect, rewrite FERIA. I mean, I think with counsel hesitation, I think on behalf of the court, we'd ask counsel's hesitation not to have a rule that they seek for what it would do.
You're going far afield from your standing argument.
Well, yes, Your Honor, I am. But in terms of standing, all the cases that are in the briefs on either side, on either party side, the applicant had a direct financial interest or other interest in the issues being litigated, not some indirect interest. So we'd ask that the district court
be affirmed. Thank you. Mr. Taylor, I think we used up all your rebuttal time. Oh, sorry, we have an intervener. Thank you.
Not an intervener.
A real party. At least at the moment. Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you out.
This is J.P. Morgan. They're going to pay all the liabilities. So.
Right.
We don't think so, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Brent McIntosh, and I represent defendants J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., and Washington Mutual Mortgage Securities Corporation, which are a couple long names that for ease of reference I'll call J.P. Morgan today. I don't intend to belabor the points ably made by counsel for the FDIC, with which we generally agree, but I do want to answer some of the questions that I think remain outstanding at this point. Judge Santel had asked the question, would every claimant have standing to intervene here? I think it's a good question. I think the question is somewhat broader, actually.
There's three of us questioning. I didn't get time to broaden it any of that.
The question really seems aimed at the FIREA context, where with the FDIC acting as receiver. Mm-hmm. But we would submit that, in fact, a decision on this intervention motion, there's nothing specific to FIREA about that decision. It really is a decision about the requirements of Rule 24A2. And so it would be substantially broader. I will say,
as the other side of the same coin, with reference to what actions people could intervene in, that is to say, there's lots of other types of actions which could be exhausting a race in which other persons would have a claim. That would not seem to me to automatically open the courthouse door to all those who might have some other claim to the same race.
Your Honor, I think it would open the courthouse doors to any situation where there was a threat of exhaustion or a threat of a change.
The slope here is rather steep and rather unusually slippery, I think.
Or any change to a pro rata distribution, which is what we have here. There's nothing specific to FIREA here, although I think that to allow intervention in to allow other claimants to intervene in a FIREA receivership action would, when there are many such actions pending across the country, would create a situation where, far from just having a single bankruptcy proceeding where all claimants are in the same proceeding, you would have a series of mini bankruptcies all over the country where any claim that was sufficiently large to be worth litigating for a set of clients like Mr. Taylor's would be, they would be interested in intervening. This is what the Ninth Circuit in Alisal called a complicated battle royale. In this case, with FIREA, you would actually have complicated battles royale. You had also asked Judge Sintel, about the remedy if the FDIC mistreats them. I think that is quite clear in the precedent of this court. If you go back to the National Trust decision in 1994, in which Judge Wald wrote a controlling concurrence in a per curiam opinion, and Judge Silverman joined that decision, the court at that time was construing 12 U.S.C. 1821J, which bars any court in the country from restraining or affecting the exercise of powers or functions of the FDIC as receiver. And Judge Wald's concurrence suggested that while that was a bar on liability, an aggrieved party, if the FDIC had gone beyond its statutory mandate or violated its statutory obligations, could sue the FDIC for damages or administrative redress, and then went on to suggest that if that were not available, that that was a judgment Congress made and Congress could make that, was entitled to make that judgment. With regard to the Mountaintop case, which we were discussing, there's a second point in addition to the fact that the court had taken into the court's registry the funds in question. There was a legal entitlement to have those funds, those specific funds, handed over to an independent trustee, which I think separates separates that case from the one presently before you. The last point I would make, which hasn't been raised today, is that while Mr. Taylor currently represents a set of clients who have the same interests, there is nothing to say that he does not represent a committee of creditors. There's not, they are each seeking to intervene. They would each be an intervener of their own and have the right to take their own actions. There would be nothing to prevent them from acting in contrary ways. If other interveners came in similarly situated, they could have, in theory, different interests. Mr. Taylor has said his clients are very interested in getting an expeditious distribution. Another set of interveners might have a different interest, which is they might want to litigate to the hilt and get the biggest possible distribution. So if there are no further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Taylor, we did use up all your time. You can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let me, if I may, close with these thoughts. Our clients own property. They own notes, at least $1.9 billion worth. Their property will be harmed if this court, if the court below and then if its firm decides this case in a certain way, and the position of our adversary is that there we may not be heard on any of those questions, notwithstanding Rule 24's obvious purpose, also considering the amendment in 1966, which broadened the test, as well as the numerous voices of this court and others, that it's to be given a practical interpretation. That is, that we are in the position of having to rely upon the FDIC for whatever happens in this litigation, may not be heard about it in any respect of it.
Counsel, I hate to prolong this, but I'm going to anyway, and it is a little bit to the side, but going back to the Jones v. PG County case, I'm not sure what your point was, in what way that case you think helps you. Wasn't the minor denied the right to intervene in that case?
Yes, but because of the representation. Not because the minor was not found to have Article III standing. Indeed, the court went to some lengths to describe the fact that the parties were looking at it through the wrong lens, then went on to hold that there was adequate representation.
So at most, there'd be a dicta from which you might draw some parallel, because the holding of the case was she could not intervene.
Well, with all due respect, the court went to some lengths to quote its own precedent in Norton
but
and
that
others.
Was not necessary to the holding in the case, the decision in the case.
I believe the panel considered it necessary to decide whether
logically, if that had not been discussed or decided, and the panel had simply said she's adequately represented no matter what else exists, the result would have been the same.
But I think the panel felt
the result would have been the same. The
panel felt it unnecessary to reach.
We don't worry about the feelings of the prior panel. We look at what the holding was.
I'll tell you what the panel said. What the panel said was we need to decide whether the district court's decision on the definition of interest is correct.
I can see why they logically discussed it, but so far as the holding, it doesn't help.
This court no doubt will make a better judgment about the force of that decision than the advocates. May I close with one
final
word?
Your time is up now.
With one final word.
Go ahead.
There are concerns about what the decision would be on other creditors, but there certainly are cases and numerous cases which hold that in some circumstances, parties who are creditors have a right to intervene because of their interest in the outcome of the underlying litigation. It is indisputable that those cases do exist, they do apply, and they've been cited with approval.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted.